16. Tomorrow, when the war began. Victoria Police Human Source 3838. A case review. 2010 to 2012. On Valentine's Day in 2011, Gobbo lost her mother to pancreatic cancer. Everyone liked Mary Gobbo. She was down to earth and friendly, no airs. Gobbo regularly had dinner with her mother on Saturday nights. As teenagers, the Gobbo sisters had also lost their father to cancer after a long struggle. On anniversaries, even decades later, Gobbo told her police handlers that she was so despondent she couldn't speak. Gobbo's lifeline through the currents of uncertainty was her sister Catherine, also a lawyer, unafraid of saying what she thought. She had been by her sister's bedside when Nicola went to hospital again in the new year of 2010. Gobbo was so anxious that Detective Sergeant Sol Solomon feared for her future. Catherine was again by her side the morning after their mother's death. There was a knock at Gobbo's door. Detective Senior Sergeant Boris Buick, unaware of the family's grief, had arrived to tell Gobbo that Paul Dale had been charged with lying to the Australian Crime Commission. Gobbo was to be called as a prosecution witness. Buick, a former Piranha detective who had arrested Farouk Orman for murder, had known since 2006 that Gobbo was a police informer. He later spoke of the awful timing of this home visit. He might have returned at an easier moment, but time was pressing. Gobbo had just cause to be stunned by the intrusion. Police were no longer supposed to contact her. In conversations over the next 24 hours, Gobbo's sister pointed out to Buick that Gobbo could not be called as a courtroom witness under the terms of her confidential settlement with Victoria Police 6 months earlier. Buick told Gobbo that the Commonwealth Director of Prosecutions, who had charged Dale, did not feel bound by the agreement. The day after her mother died, when she might have been receiving sympathetic calls and arranging a funeral, Gobbo was being squeezed again by Victoria Police. As Buick later recounted, he told her that the Dale matter hasn't gone away for her, and it didn't matter that police had paid her almost $3 million to go away. Sometime later, Gobbo ran into her first legal boss, Levi Diamond, who was representing John Higgs, the co-accused of her client Rob Karam in the tomato tins importation case. Diamond offered her casual employment, obviously unaware that she had tried to jail him 13 years earlier. Diamond thought she seemed miserable, not at all like the young woman he had hired in 1997. He wondered about her advice to his clients that contradicted his own. He felt he was being undermined. She went behind Diamond's back. He wonders now, without evidence, if she was still acting as an agent of police at this time. Gobbo's wider family had abandoned Nicola long ago, but the family unit, including half-sister Linda, tried to stay close. Catherine and Nicola fell out at some point. Perhaps the stress got too much for the younger sister, whose own commercial law work presumably suffered due to the Gobbo stigma. Nicola would say in courtroom evidence in 2017 that she told Catherine at a later stage about aspects of her informing, probably before 2014. She would say in 2020, "And I prefer, if it is possible, I don't say much about her, because I've caused enough damage to her." As Diamond says of Catherine Gobbo, "Nicola cursed us both, Catherine by birth and me as her boss." In mid-2011, a few months after her mother's death, Gobbo's secret history came perilously close to being exposed in open court. Steve Svetanovsky was facing a June 2011 trial for drug offences related to Gobbo's 2006 sting that uncovered a Mockbell drug lab. Early in 2006, he had secured a meth lab site in Strathmore. Gobbo passed information about the lab to police, her first salvo against the Mockbell empire. 5 years later, the star witness against Svetanovsky was in the witness box at his trial. Svetonovsky and the witness were once mates. They'd shared an interest in strippers and in gambling. Svetonovsky once lost $400,000 in a betting splurge at Jupiter's casino on the Gold Coast, the price of money laundering. Svetonovsky's barrister, Michael Penarese, was a thrusting personality with an ear for the absurd. He sought to sow doubt in the courtroom. Drawing on every available avenue, he trod the fraught line of impugning the reputation of a fellow barrister. In attempting to discredit the star witness, Penarese probed the man's perceived intimacy with Gobbo. He asked why Gobbo had been spotted with him on police surveillance tapes in the weeks before the drug lab sting. "Can I ask you now, when was it that you purchased a diamond ring for Gobbo?" he probed. "Do you disagree that you've mentioned to many people, many of your friends, that you purchased a $35,000 diamond engagement ring for Gobbo?" The witness described the suggestion as rubbish. Penarese declared that Gobbo's involvement in the case stinks. Justice Jim Montgomery didn't go as far, though he did say that Gobbo appeared to be redefining conflict of interest. "Apart from the fact that she's a barrister, and she seems to be, on the evidence of this trial, one of dubious ethical standards in relation to conflict of interest, she seems to be acting for everyone," he said. "Someone keeps telling me she's back in practice. I can't understand how." There was open court discussion about putting Gobbo in the witness box. The case prosecutor was John Champion, SC, soon to become Victorian Director of Public Prosecutions. Champion told the court he would inquire about claims that Gobbo had conspired to concoct statements, false statements, with the concurrence of the members of the Piranha Task Force. The suggestion didn't lead anywhere. If it had, Gobbo's secret might have emerged long before it did. Champion, nevertheless, would be a key player in the Gobbo revelations over the years ahead. In a 2015 letter, Svetonovsky claimed that the star witness had been improperly coached through contradictory claims in making statements against him. Svetonovsky felt he was the victim of an unethical conspiracy. He was right. Soon Gobbo would lose the most ardent keeper of her secret. On the 16th of June 2011, Simon Overland resigned after he was shown to have signed off on misleading crime statistics before the 2010 Victorian state election. "I've always sought to act in the best interests of the organisation in an honourable way, and I believe this is the appropriate thing to do," he said. Overland's announcement was not unexpected. Overland kept secrets, that much is obvious, though his biggest would remain hidden for a few more years. Overland's deputy, Sir Ken Jones, had resigned the previous month. Overland exacerbated his long, festering feud with Sir Ken by ordering him to leave before he could serve out his notice. Sir Ken had a formidable resume built over years of policing in Britain and elsewhere. He was no yes man. He had queried Overland's use of crime statistics, the directions applied to Petra investigators, and the 2010 payout to Gobbo. Sir Ken was mistrustful of Overland's penchant for phone taps, and he wondered at their legality. In 2019, he said he made discreet inquiries about the use of Gobbo as an informer. Sir Ken was popular. Overland was not. Overland's style of leadership had galvanized powerful enemies against him. He'd reached the top job because he'd supervised the jailing of gangland figures. But he soon faced calls for a royal commission into his politics over policing style from his former deputy, Sir Ken. Instead, Overland would confront a royal commission into the bigger secret of Nicola Gobbo. The case against Paul Dale for murdering Terry Hodson had been dismissed soon after Williams's death, but Victoria Police still wanted to nail Dale. This was why Buick had turned up at Gobbo's door. In charging Dale for lying under oath to the Australian Crime Commission, police relied on Dale's recorded cafe chat with Gobbo in 2008 as a key piece of evidence. In response, Dale's lawyers once again sought documents relating to Gobbo. Once again, Victoria Police opted to impede the pursuit of justice by making the Gobbo secret the higher priority. They dragged Commonwealth prosecutors into the hidden conspiracy of Gobbo. Behind the scenes, harried negotiations swirled between Victoria Police and prosecutors. In November 2011, Victoria Police sent their new assistant commissioner to plead the need for Gobbo's removal. Graham Ashton, of course, had been actively involved in the Gobbo conundrum for years through his role at the Office of Police Integrity. He was ostensibly concerned about the risks to Gobbo's safety if her informer past were teased out in the witness box. Police boasted a transparent excuse for Gobbo's removal from the trial. She was once again being threatened. A sympathy card had been sent to her lawyer. "Tell your client she is dead. Dogs die dead." Police never traced the source of the menacing. It was of a kind that usually does not excuse a witness from giving evidence, yet it elevated Gobbo to the highest risk category. At a meeting, the prosecutors rejected Ashton's argument for removing Gobbo. According to one source, Ashton then revealed Gobbo's informer status. Victoria Police got their way. The ACC did not alert Dale's legal team to Gobbo's history of informing. Instead, they yielded and removed Gobbo from the case. At a preliminary hearing, a prosecutor told the court Gobbo would not be taking the stand. It was odd that Victoria Police thought Gobbo could give evidence in the first place. It's unclear how she was meant to testify against Dale while avoiding questions of credibility. Was she supposed to lie under oath? Off camera, the subpoena from Dale's lawyers had caused ructions within Victoria Police. If the request had been successful, documents exposing Gobbo's informing would have been introduced in open court. Victoria Police hired barrister Gerard Maguire, who had appeared for the force in many cases over many years, to appraise the situation. In October 2011, he recommended a police review of all cases involving Nicola Gobbo. If some of gangland's biggest thugs realised that Gobbo had snitched on them, he argued, they would start queuing up to claim that their convictions should be overturned. His notion is hardly startling now, given the scandalised descriptions of Gobbo's informing that fill media waves. Nor should it have been that surprising within Victoria Police in 2011, given the brave voices within the force who had already questioned Gobbo's use. Senior command, including Graham Ashton, met to discuss the issues. Victoria Police resolved to hire a former Police Chief Commissioner, Neil Comrie, to produce a report, Victoria Police Human Source 3838, a case review, was finalised in June 2012. To this day, Comrie's findings are disputed by those who participated in the Gobbo subterfuge. Yet his analysis is a sensible starting point for understanding how the secret abuse of power flourishes when public officials set aside the rules. Comrie is gifted with a plain style of writing foreign to most legal documents. His message was unambiguous, a portent of similar conclusions later reached by others. Comrie's message about police use of Gobbo was this: wrong, wrong, and wrong. Comrie quoted Superintendent Tony Biggin, who supervised the force's covert operations at the time, as saying that 3838 created an opportunity for Victoria Police that has never before been encountered, and in all probability will never be encountered again. Comrie described Gobbo as a complex, manipulative, and conniving person, and spoke of her as somewhat bizarrely expressing desires to be the best human source to have ever assisted Victoria Police. He noted that she was initially motivated by her desire to eject the Mockbills from her life. Her unethical choices were driven not by community spirit, but by displeasure at her personal circumstances. Upturning the justice system was, ultimately, about her. The police, meanwhile, were ill-prepared for an abundantly self-confident source, possessing a very strong and forceful personality. Petra detectives, in particular, had had significant problems in managing her. This served to further empower 3838, who was now even more savvy and battle-hardened in making demands of Victoria Police. Comrie concluded that the Source Development Unit, SDU records, were incomplete and disjointed. Monthly assessments at management meetings were like cut-and-paste exercises in note-taking. He compiled a step-by-step guide in due diligence. From day one, it should have been established that Gobbo must not provide privileged information to police investigators. Gobbo was somewhat misguided in her grasp of the legal and ethical concerns, Comrie said. He queried whether Gobbo was informing to police to make money. If she was, it was inappropriate for her to represent clients she had previously informed on. Comrie noted that legal concerns were raised by SDU members in 2008 with Overland, then a deputy commissioner. Comrie discovered no records showing any further consideration of the legalities. He presented the SDU with a prospective get-out-of-jail card. Given the lack of oversight and documentation, they were free to assume that senior management condoned their use of Gobbo. Loss of public or judicial confidence in the use of informers would undermine the future effectiveness of the informer program, Comrie wrote. Conduct that sapped such confidence but was kept hidden from view could not be tolerated. It was inappropriate for police to actively seek information from a human source when police are aware that this is being provided contrary to the human source's professional obligations. The use of protected information, bar unusual circumstances, amounts to a conspiracy which undermines the justice system. Entries contained in the 3838 information reports, taken at face value, indicate that on many occasions, 3838, in providing information to police handlers about 3838's clients, has disregarded legal professional privilege, Comrie wrote. It is open to interpret that such conduct may have potentially interfered with the right of a fair trial for those concerned. There it was, in black and white, in June 2012, almost 6.5 years before any of Gobbo's former clients would be notified of her deception. What did Victoria Police do with the Comrie review? Let's assume that senior command considered the convictions that might be tainted, and the individuals, perhaps dozens, doing lengthy jail terms as a result. Let's assume that police brass considered the question of criminal conduct by some serving Victoria Police officers. What did Victoria Police do? They told the Director of Public Prosecutions, John Champion, about Gobbo, but they did not provide him with the relevant documentation. Then they invoked the supreme protocol of all creaking bureaucracies. They ordered another review. Operation Lorikated had one job. It sounded simple. This secret police review, prompted by a secret police review, compile all the police materials relating to Gobbo into a single file. But it wasn't simple. The Victoria Police records were shambolic. It took 18 months to decipher them. Meanwhile, Tony Mockbell was sentenced for a string of drug trafficking offences a month after Comrie's review was submitted, unaware that Victoria Police already knew his convictions might be tainted. Police had ample time to alert the courts to this potential miscarriage of justice. They did nothing. Victoria Police knew that they had seriously erred, and that some of their officers might have committed crimes years before Anthony Dalsley told the world about it. And they've tried to hide it ever since.